All right, welcome everyone. It's Sunday afternoon. This is Revolution Radio's Can't Look Ball. I'm Stephen Roberts. Today I have on a very special guest. He's a contributor to the U.S. Independent with Suzanne Pozell, as well as I am too. I'm trying to get as many, if not all, of the contributors to the U.S. Independent on one of my shows to get a perspective of many different people all around the world. She has contributors. But today, my show is with Stephen Lindemann. He's from Chicago. He's a journalist. as I mentioned, Stephen Lindemann, good grief, I wish I had his blog up here right now. I could tell you what it is, but I'm going to let Steve plug his sites himself, along with the U.S. Independent. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Oh, it's happy to be with you, Stephen. My blog site is one I set up for myself. I did it when I began writing it. I did it only to keep my articles in chronological order. And it's very easy to access. Just Google my last name, Lindemann, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. It'll take you right to the site. Very simple. And you'll be able to see my articles. I've got two new ones coming up. I did three today, Stephen. I've got two I'm planning for tomorrow. I have no idea whether I'll do a third one, but I've got two. And one I call Ukraine Ground Zero for Possible World War III. It's no overstatement. It's a very great possibility. Am I predicting it? No. But the possibility exists. And I do a lot of media critiques, Stephen. My favorite punching bag is the New York Times. I'm sure their people know me well. And I've got a dramatic title I'm using for tomorrow. I simply say, NYT, Russia bashing, stench. And my opening line explains the former Chicago City News Bureau. I'll just read it. In 2005, Chicago's famed City News Bureau closed. Times correspondents, contributors, and editors ignored its notable principle. It said, quote, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out with two independent sources. How about that for a quote, Stephen?
Yeah, two independent, reliable sources, correct?
Indeed so. Indeed. I think that's a great quote.
Yeah, that sounds like a good one. We're gonna be discussing mainly the Ukraine and the implications of what can happen over there and what's going to happen with the world as far as a world view over there.
It's a very grave situation, Stephen. Without exaggeration, I call the Ukraine crisis the gravest one since World War II. It's no exaggeration. The Cuban Missile Crisis was very, very significant, but we had Jack Kennedy as president then. After the fact, when the dust settled, he said, and I quoted him, he never had any intention of attacking Cuba. But we had Kennedy then, and we have Obama today. His administration and Washington overall is infested with neocon extremists. I wouldn't put anything past them. Kennedy was different. He was elected as a Cold Warrior. He transformed himself in less than a few years in office to a peacemaker. He was the last peacemaking president America had, and he paid for it with his life.
Yes, he did. maybe you can give me your perspective on why do you think Putin and Russia wants to hold on so badly to the Ukraine? Is it is there some economic reason, or is it just a ancestral or maybe a historical reason?
What Putin really wants, Stephen, is an independent Ukraine. After the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, or before it dissolved, I believe it was in 1989, Bush 1 promised then-President Mikhail Gorbachev that America had no designs on incorporating or dominating former Russian republics or Warsaw Pact countries. Bush 1 lied because most of them have either been incorporated into NATO or NATO, U.S.-controlled NATO, I should say, has designs on doing it. Ukraine is the crown jewel. It's a major country. It's the major one in Central Europe. It's the major former Russian Republic. It shares an approximate 1,500-mile border, 1,500-kilometer, I believe, border with Russia. If it gets incorporated into NATO, There'll be U.S. bases on Russia's border. You're already encroaching Russia's border and China's border, and no country would tolerate a threat like that. Russia doesn't want to tolerate it. Putin doesn't want to tolerate it. America wouldn't tolerate it. China wouldn't tolerate it. That's the issue. He wants an independent Ukraine. He didn't choose to incorporate Crimea. Crimeans did by a scrupulously fair, open, and free vote. Independent monitors said so. They didn't find a single irregularity in March when the vote took place. 96.7%, an astonishing percentage of Crimeans voted for reunification with Russia. It was part of Russia until 1954. Crimeans wanted it back. The turnout was 83%. How could any leader say no? If I was the president of Russia, Stephen, I absolutely would have said yes. And that's exactly what Putin did. He's got no designs on Ukraine. He wants Ukraine independent. He does not want NATO bases on his border. And he has every right not to want them. He considers it an act of war, and I agree with him.
Sure, I do too. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Ukraine has the most used. It's the biggest port over there too, isn't it? Or it's one of the biggest port. It's a major port.
Ukraine has the Black Sea.
Yes,
on the Black Sea. Now a big part of that was Crimea. You know, I haven't looked at a map lately, and I'm not certain what's left after Crimea was gone. Because Crimea, the peninsula on the southern border, the southeastern border of Ukraine, surrounded by water. So Crimea really is the port of the country, and the Ukrainian fleet was based in Crimea, but it's all gone now. It's
okay.
Taken out.
Okay.
And now Crimea is part of Russia by the volition of the current Crimean people. I'm not certain what ports Ukraine has left on the Black Sea. I'm going to have to check that. That's a good point.
Okay. Do you think there's a conspiracy behind the massing of American and troops and other countries just heading into the area?
Key point, Steve. Key point. Absolutely. I've said this so many times and I've written this so many times. America tolerates no independent states. It wants all independent states transformed into subservient pro-Western ones. It especially wants no rival states, major rival states. The only two states in that category are China and Russia. China mainly an economic powerhouse, the second biggest economy in the world. In a half dozen of years or so, it'll match America's economic might. It's also a military power in its own right. And it's a huge country, powerful country, influential country. Russia, a much smaller country, population, about half of America's. But it's the only country that can match America militarily, blow for blow. Nuclear arsenal, delivery systems, doesn't have as many as America has. But how many do you need? It could destroy America in less than a day. America could do the same to Russia. So America wants these rivals removed. It wants them transformed into subservient vassal states, pro-Western. That's what it's all about. Ukraine is a pretext. If it wasn't Ukraine, it would be something else.
Yes, there was the key word you just happened to mention, and then you mentioned it again, pro-Western. Isn't that just a euphemism or a code word for pro-American corporation?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I absolutely believe, and I think if I had access to official documents that I don't, Stephen, I could prove that a lot of the policies that EU countries go along with America are ones they don't want to go along with, but they're threatened, they're bullied, they're pressured, and they're absolutely forced to go along with things that harm their own interests. And that's the way America operates. NATO is a U.S.-dominated organization. It never was for defense. It always was for offense. And 75% of the funding comes from America. So he who pays the piper calls the tune, as they say. And America controls NATO, and all of these EU countries are part of NATO. They literally have no say. They're forced to go along with what harms their welfare. One of these days, they're going to rebel. I don't know what they're waiting for.
Well, it just seems here in the past, since the end of the war, Merrick has just been the sheriff or the police department for the EU, for the older European elite families, banks, if you will. Some call them banks, some call them families, but
crime families are good.
Yeah. America just seems to be the bully for the European interest. I wonder if people are actually ever going to get the idea what the real truth is.
Well, the real truth is America doesn't care about the interests of any other country but its own. It uses other countries, but of course it needs allies. It can't do everything in isolation. It's the most powerful country militarily. It still is economically. It still has enormous political influence, but it's waning, Stephen. Its military power is the only one that remains dominant, but Russia is powerful, China is powerful, America's economic might is waning, its political might is waning, and there are some very distinguished people who believe that America's might began eroding back during the Korean War. The last war America won, Stephen, was World War II. Didn't win Korea, didn't win Vietnam, didn't win in Central America, didn't win in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Libya or in Syria. If it wages war with Iran, it's madness. It won't win that one either. And if it wages war with Russia, heaven help us all. It's Armageddon. That's what it is.
Yes, it is. And some will argue, Steve, that wars today aren't really supposed to be won. They're just supposed to be sustained long enough for corporate interest.
Well, the only ones that profit by them are the war profiteers. And the war profiteers are many, many more, Stephen, than the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings. They're the banks. They're all the companies, the tech companies, the suppliers of everything a military needs, which is virtually everything. The same stuff you and I need and your viewers, Stephen, are the same things that America's military needs. You know the old saying, a military marches on its stomach. And it needs everything. It needs toothpaste. It needs toilet paper. It needs drugs when it's sick. It needs everything. So all of these companies profit, and there's enormous money to be made, and they love wars, and they just want them fought for the profits that they can make. You want to know how to end wars, Stephen? Take the profit out of them. It end today.
Well, yeah, you take the profit out of them, but you also want to end wars today is tell your children not to sign up for the military.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there really is sort of an unofficial draft today because the job market is so abysmal. The so-called 6.7, whatever percent official unemployment rate is, it's what I call a big lie. Based on the way unemployment was calculated in the 1980s, the real unemployment rate is 23.2%. That's depression level. If people don't find jobs, if they need an income, they look for any way to get it. A lot of them, in desperation, sign up for the military. They're sold a bill of goods. They're lied to, free education, free health care, free other benefits. And very few of these kids ever see any of these things when they come out. Again, they were lied to, and too many of them come back traumatized, physically injured, never the same again. When they're not needed anymore, they're thrown out like yesterday's garbage. The worst decision young people can make is join the U.S. military. You're absolutely guaranteed to be betrayed. And many, my goodness, hundreds of thousands have been betrayed. Stephen, I've sat at the VA. I'm a vet, 1950s vintage. I've sat at the VA with Vietnam vets, not talking about Vietnam, we're just chatting with them. They were there for the same thing I was, to get prescription drugs. I don't go there anymore because it's a real hassle. I can get them. I can save money. But they really put you through the rigmarole, and it just isn't worth it. You go sit there for hours. You see an intern. You have to bring your own doctor's prescription. You have to take their version of a physical exam. It's a waste of time. Why can't they just give me a prescription without any hocus pocus? So I finally stopped going. But a few times I went there, and I sat with Vietnam vets, and I chatted with them. They just weren't normal people, Stephen. You could see it in their eyes. You could see it in their body language. All these years after Vietnam, they were still traumatized. They still weren't the same people. The last time I went, it might have been 8 or 9 years ago. It's been a very long time. So it was back in the early part of the new millennium. But I won't forget it because those people affected me and they didn't want to talk about what they went through in Vietnam. Well, I've read enough about it and I know enough about it to have a pretty good understanding of what they did go through. The kids that went over there were fresh kids. They had futures to look forward to and they came back just decimated. Many of them physically, too many of them emotionally. And America, again, just threw them out like yesterday's garbage. The same thing happens to the kids today. Don't care about them.
No, they don't. excuse me a second here. No, they don't, really. I think the current statistics are 1 in 17 of our armed forces personnel are committing suicide. That's of over many, many ages. It doesn't matter whether you're 19 or you're 89.
Oh, very true, Steve. It's been a while. I think it's been a couple of years ago. I think if I remember right, I think it was just about a couple of years ago, I wrote an article about military suicides. There are more when the kids come out of the military than when they're in it. And the numbers are absolutely startling. Maybe a couple of dozen a day. And those were the numbers then. It may be more now. And why do kids commit suicide? Because they can't take the pressure anymore. They simply can't put up with it. It's better to take their own lives, even after they get home. They're not the same people. And they want to end the pain that they endure on a daily basis. Yes, others, because of what they're trained to do, they're trained to be killers, and they come home trained killers. Some of them commit murder. Some of them kill family members. Some of them kill their wives. They didn't go over there, these kind of people, but that's the way they came back. For what? For what, Stephen? For fighting imperial wars, lawless aggression, and again, America doesn't win them, but millions of lives attest to America's brutality.
Yes, it is. Yes. They're finding out once they get in and go over to Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere else, you know, Fallujah. It's not all the glamour that they see on the TV or the movie screen, and good people, good men and women, they just can't murder without having something affect them, and a lot of times they are not asked but told to murder. Go in and wipe out this town or something, and go in and wipe out this area. There's a suspected terrorist in this group of 20, 30, 40, 50 people, and we don't know which one it is, so you have to take them all out. And it just, it eats at people.
Oh, that's exactly right, Stephen. The military knows that ordinary people, not just Americans, but ordinary people everywhere, don't have a predilection to kill. The only way you can get people to kill is to train them to kill. I remember a marvelous song from the Rodgers and Hammerstein 1940s musical, South Pacific. And I don't have the lyrics in front of me, but I remember I quoted them in an article I wrote sometime back. And I think the title is, You have to be taught to kill. And one of the lines is, you have to be taught, you have to be carefully taught. And it's true. People don't have a predilection to kill. You have to teach them to kill. You have to teach them that we're the good guys and we're sending you over to fight the bad guys, to bring democracy to people who don't have it. And they drop that into these young people's brains day after day after day in training. And then they train them with the weapons used and so on. And they literally transform peaceful people into cold-blooded killers. And they're the ones they send abroad to believe that when they come up against Afghans or Iraqis or anybody, these are the bad guys, and you're doing a service to get rid of these people by killing them. Shocking.
Yes, it is. Yes. And whether it's even true or not, that's irrelevant to the top brass, you know. It doesn't even matter whether it's true or not what they're told.
Oh, indeed. And I've written about a so-called rules of engagement in Iraq. And I'm certain there's rules of engagement in all U.S. combat theaters. And the rules are very simple, Stephen. I quote it verbatim. I can quote it verbatim. Kill all military-aged Iraqis on site, quote unquote. I'll say it again. This comes down from the top, from the Pentagon to the field commanders, to the lower-level commanders, to the rank-and-file troops. Quote, kill all military-aged Iraqis on site. Just change the word Iraqi to Afghans,
sure.
Syrians, Syrian. Philippians,
Ukrainians.
Ukrainians.
Yeah. Iranians. Yeah.
And what is the military age Iraqi?
Well, that covers.
What do these kids understand? I mean, there's anybody that gets their gun sights into.
Yeah, that can over in some of them Middle Eastern countries that can go as far as 12, 13, 14 years old up to 60s. Up to the age of 60 or even past, you know? That covers a wide range of men.
Well, Israel practices this. It doesn't say it that. And I don't have a document with Israel's rules of engagement, but they go after kids. Just the other day, if you can believe this, Israeli soldiers arrested a 6-year-old Palestinian. If you can imagine that, and they accused him of stone throwing. I think they released him a short time afterwards. A six-year-old kid doesn't know what the heck is going on. I pretty much remember when I was 6 years old. I had no understanding of the world around me. I was 5 years old when World War I began. I had no idea, Stephen. I entered kindergarten that year.
Yeah, yeah, well, I, of course, have no idea what anything past, the Korean War and that, or I remember stuff being shown on TV for the Vietnam War, but the first war that actually became some described it as a mini series was the 1991 Gulf War. It was almost like a 3-day mini series.
Oh, indeed, 4 weeks, either 4 or 5 weeks. There's a number I think I remember: 144 U.S. casualties, most of them, Stephen, friendly fire.
Is that right?
If you can imagine that. And something like 100,000 Iraqis were killed, including Iraqis in trenches, and the commanders ordered bulldozers to bury them alive. Bury them alive.
Oh, wow.
100,000 Iraqi soldiers that wanted no part of Saddam's war, but they had no choice.
Well, there was reports I've heard come out after the war, of course, that Iraqi troops, there were some number of Iraqi troops that tried to surrender. And
oh, indeed.
They were just mowed down by coalition.
That's exactly right. Yeah. They were just mowed down and slaughtered. I mean, how do you kill 100,000 people in 4 or 5 weeks? I mean, that really is mass destruction. And the true story of the Gulf War is completely different than the one we were told. Saddam never wanted that war. He never wanted to invade Kuwait. He was suckered into doing it. He literally was lied to. America's ambassador, April Glaspie, he asked permission. Kuwait was told by America to cross drill and steal Iraqi oil. And Saddam tried negotiating with Kuwait for months.
They
got nowhere. Finally, he got fed up, as anybody would. And he wanted to take matters in his own hands, but he wouldn't do it without U.S. permission because he didn't want to get himself in trouble. And April Glaspie, I remember her name. She was U.S. ambassador at the time, Bush's ambassador. He asked permission, and she said something like, America won't stand in your way.
Yeah.
But we have no dog in this fight.
Yeah.
And he invaded Kuwait, and the rest is history.
Well, it wasn't so much Kuwait. Wasn't it American corporate interests that were drilling sideways into Iraq?
I'm not sure. I think the main issue was America wanted Iraq destroyed and controlled, but Bush got people in Washington very angry. Because when the war ended in 4 or 5 weeks, he didn't go all the way to Baghdad. We put 600,000 troops into Iraq, and he didn't take them all the way to Baghdad. It remained until 2003 for Bush 2 to do it. But there were people in Washington, the neocons, that were furious with him for not doing it. I'm not sure why he stopped, but he did.
Well, there again, we get into the argument of a sustainability conflict. It was over, like you said, in a matter of weeks, and corporate interests probably didn't make the money they wanted to, so they had to let Saddam stay in power until another time. I don't know. This is just an argument.
Well, they let it go for a good long while. Bill Clinton actually waged war he waged plenty of war on Iraq. He did it two ways. A lot of people know about the sanctions. What they don't know is it killed 1.5 million Iraqis. 1.5 million Iraqis. No exaggeration. What they don't know was he intermittently bombed Iraq. I don't know how many times, but there was a no-fly zone. The Kurdish area in the north, the Shia area mainly in the south, the central Baghdad area, the Sunni area, that was the Iraq that was left alone. But the others were no-fly zones. So Iraq couldn't fly their aircraft there. But Clinton intermittently bombed Iraq many times, killed I don't know how many Iraqis. So Clinton, during his 8 years, waged war on Iraq, and then Bush picked it up when he came in, and we had the Iraq War too.
Yeah, yeah. Some, I'm one of them, but some people think that we're, Barack Obama is just in the, let me see, it would be the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the seventh term of George Bush Sr.'s presidency with nothing changing over the last it's been 1992, 22 years, yeah.
Oh, without question. I'll even go you one better than that, Steve. And I say Obama exceeded the worst of George Bush. And I really believe that. A few years, I wrote a year-end article about Obama, just summarizing his crimes, domestic and foreign crimes, during the year. I mean, his rap sheet is so extreme. One war after another, direct wars, proxy wars. How many people know about his war in Yemen, his war on Somalia?
Yes.
The fact that U.S. Special Forces are in over 120 countries worldwide, and they really are trained killers. They're experts in killing. That's what Special Forces are.
Yes.
Over 120 countries, and they don't come as goodwill ambassadors. They come to make mischief, to cause instability, and that's what they do. And that's what Obama does. He broke every major promise he made, Stephen. I honestly say he's worse than George Bush.
Well, sure. He's the joke is he has outbushed Bush, and he's Bush on steroids as far as the warmongering. And the American media just give him a pass on everything, where they would have been howling like banshees if Bush would have twitched his eye wrong.
Oh, indeed. I mean, the New York Times would have gotten on George Bush in a minute. And the New York Times praises Obama, says nothing about his crimes. The Republicans bash Obama's domestic policies. So they don't like Obamacare. They don't like some other things. And they say he hasn't gone far enough overseas. What in the hell do they want him to do? I mean, he's destroyed one country after another. How much more death and destruction do they want him to do? So they bash him for not doing more. But of course, they support his imperial policies. The New York Times supports his imperial policies.
Sure, sure. The military-industrial complex is, I think they're making $1 billion a week.
Oh, they're making so much money. They love Obama. Again, just wage the wars and keep on waging them, because you wage them and the profits keep pouring in, and they're making tons of money.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
There was one article I wrote. Oh, I think the information came from Reuters. A surprising article in Reuters, a very in-depth one, Stephen, that from something like 1996, from maybe another decade, the Pentagon lost on the order of $8 trillion they can't account for. $8 trillion. Well, this is stuff that all goes for war making. In 10 years, if they can't account for $8 trillion, Stephen, maybe they'll come up with a bigger number that they can't account for.
Sure. Well, my thinking is they can account for it. It's just that they don't want to.
They don't want to.
Yeah. They have so much allocated for the black budgets, the unseen money that has always been there, the unseen projects. Can you speak to any kind of credence to reports of hundreds and hundreds of these special forces and American troops being killed and not reported on in some of these countries over there? Maybe they're trying to create strife over there or trying to create coups, and they end up getting killed?
I've never written on that topic, but I did write about one. Obama's fake killing of Osama bin Laden. Fake. Bin Laden, and the New York Times reported this, Fox News reported it, the BBC reported it. Osama was a sick man. He had kidney disease. He had other illnesses. He died in a Pakistani hospital in December 2001. I quoted directly from a New York Times article in July 2002. I could do a little digging and go back and find my article. It was a very brief New York Times article, but it was there in black and white. Obama's claim killing was fake.
Well, sure it was.
The special forces that were involved in raiding the so-called building that he was allegedly housed in, I believe they died in a mysterious plane crash. They were killed to shut them up because they didn't go after Osama. They didn't find Osama. I don't know who they killed in that building. I don't know what they did, but they certainly didn't kill Osama. And they were killed to shut them up. And I think they came out in one or more helicopters, and they went down to kill them, to silence them.
Well,
I forget the exact number, Stephen. It may have been as many as 60.
That could be, but there are 22 confirmed that were supposedly to have been on that that helicopter that crashed in a exercise, of course. But it just happened to be the same 22 that went into the complex and allegedly killed bin Laden. But all reports all around the world did seemingly say that bin Laden was dead by the year 2002. And also what just millions and millions of people don't want to see and they don't want to hear is bin Laden was also a CIA asset in the 80s.
Oh, he sure was, through the Pakistani ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. He didn't know he was a CIA asset, but he sure was. He was used in Afghanistan against the Soviet invaders in the 1980s. And then he was used on and off.
Yes, he was. Sorry, I was just trying to respond to somebody.
And I'll add one more thing to that, Stephen.
Okay.
Al-Qaeda is used both as enemies and as assets, sometimes at the same time. It really is amazing. But Al-Qaeda is an important U.S. asset, and it's also used as a U.S. enemy. It was used as an ally in Iraq against Assad. It's being used right now in Syria against Assad. And at the same time, it's vilified and called an enemy.
Yeah. And they're also funded, trained, and backed by U.S. interests.
Very definitely.
U.S. State Department. Yeah.
State Department, U.S. Special Forces.
Yeah.
And probably Pakistani ISI.
Oh, most assuredly. And also Saudi Arabia likes to... they like to fund...
Saudi Arabia has the deep pockets.
Yes, they do. It just gets me. My stepdad is 73, and he thinks Al Qaeda and bin Laden was the boogeyman, but then yet he does see these reports on Fox News that Al Qaeda and the boogeyman are being funded by U.S. interests, and it doesn't really register in his head.
Does Fox News really say that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
They actually report something accurate.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. I don't watch Fox News, so I don't know.
I don't either.
Bravo, Fox News.
Yeah, I mean, and it really kind of blows his mind because he knows that they're supposed to be the bad guy, but then yet we're turning right around and funding them and training them, and he just doesn't get it.
Well, things can register late sometimes with people. My dad, I'm a bit older than you, Steve, and my dad was in World War I in France, and we never talked about it at home, and I have no idea what he went through, whether he saw combat or what he saw, but he came back in one piece, and the only connection between him and World War I was a souvenir pistol unloaded he had in his desk, and I held it in my hand a few times, but again, he never wanted to talk about his experience in the war, and I never asked him.
Yeah. I think my grandfather was the same way. He saw action in the Pacific with the Japanese, and he was captured by the Japanese.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, my grandmother told us never to ask him about it because he just didn't want to talk about it, and he wasn't going to talk about it. And I believe he told her when he got back, but he never really told anyone else. I did hear stories that men had to eat rats and bugs and other just nasty things just to survive, and they saw a lot of horrific things over there. But
well, I can tell you this: I read a terrific book I recommend to anybody It's called War Without Mercy. My goodness, I forget the author. But I think if anybody Googles, Google Amazon and Google War Without Mercy, and you'll find the book. You can get it in paperback, used, cheap. And the evidence in that book is so overwhelming that the Japanese were brutal in the war, and America matched them blow for blow. U.S. brutality was just as vicious as what the Japanese did. It's all there in black and white.
Yes, it is. Yes. I guess while we got about 12 or 13 minutes left, we can go back to the original subject of the Ukraine.
Can I mention the book that I'm working on?
Sure, absolutely.
It's called Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. It's almost done. The contributors are very, very special. They're marvelous, distinguished people. I feel like a pygmy in the land of the giants. Clarity Press asked me to serve as editor for and contributor to the book. I've got a few of my own chapters in it. The other contributors are very, very special people. The content is extremely important. It explains what the situation in Ukraine is all about, why it matters, where we may be headed for. It probably will be published within a month. I have all the content in except two final chapters. And just before I went on here with you, Stephen, one of my contributors said his chapter is all done. He wants to look it over one final time. He'll send it to me on Monday. The other contributor said he'll get it to me by May 1, the latest. My editor at Clarity Press is going through all this, doing her job. Then comes the typesetting, the printing, the distribution, the promotion. Within a few weeks, the book will be out. Anybody can Google Amazon, Google Flashpoint in Ukraine. It's already on the Amazon site. Anybody can pre-order it. I mean, it's a book I'm very closely associated with. It isn't a book I wrote to make a buck, because I'm not going to make anything on this book. And part of it is what I wrote. And the other contributor, none of them contributed to make a buck, because nobody's going to make anything from this book. They contributed to this book to put out vital information. It's extremely important, and I recommend it for that reason. I really hope listeners, viewers, Stephen, will go out and buy it when it's available. I guarantee they won't be disappointed. I've read everything but the final two chapters, and I know because of the contributors that they will be magnificent. Terrific people, distinguished professors. One's a retired professor. The other is an ongoing professor. People I respect greatly. And the others are professors. The others are magnificent people. And the content that they gave me was very, very special. Anybody who buys this book will believe they got it cheap. They got a magnificent book. They learned a lot of things they need to know they didn't know before. And what they spent was pennies to find it out. Yeah. Get it, buy it, read it, tell others about it. Flashpoint in Ukraine, Amazon, check it out.
Do you want to mention the other contributors' names? Or?
I'll read them all.
Are there quite a few?
Oh, well, here it is. Rick Rozoff. Rick runs the Stop NATO website, a website I recommend very strongly.
I know the name, yes.
James Petras, retired professor emeritus, a good friend. John McMurtry, retired professor, a good friend. Michelle Chosudovsky, a retired professor. He is the editor of the Global Research website. Jack Rasmus, an economist, a political economist, I think is the best way to describe him. He's a professor in California. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey is the editor of Project Censored. Peter is the former editor of Project Censored. They're both professors in California. Robert Abelly, he's a professor at the same university as Mickey Huff in California. Jeffrey Summers, a University of Wisconsin professor. Michael Hudson, a University of Kansas professor. Michael and Jeff sent me extraordinary chapters. I don't want to demean anybody else, because James Petras sent me several absolutely magnificent must reading. But again, Michael Hudson, Edward Herman, and David Peterson. David is an independent writer. Edward Herman is a retired Wharton School professor. I'm a Wharton grad. He was a researcher at Wharton when I came there as a grad student. We've gotten to know each other. We've never met. He's retired. They're both contributing a chapter. Andrew Colin, a professor at an Eastern University. Matthew Witt, a professor at a California university, John Cozy, a retired professor, University of Texas, Marty Nazemroya, a Middle East expert, and Rodney Shakespeare. Rodney, I asked belatedly. I asked him weeks in advance when I learned about it. He declined because his wife was dying. She passed away. I got back to him. He's a regular on my program, a magnificent guest, and I asked him whether he'd like to come back on my program again. It was about 3 or 4 weeks after his wife passed away. He said, sure, I'll come on. And as an afterthought, I said, I wonder whether you might have time to contribute to my book on Ukraine. He not only said he would, but within 24 hours, he sent me a magnificent chapter. Magnificent. My Clarity editor absolutely loved it. She made a point of telling me it is a magnificent chapter. He teaches, let's learn how to describe it. He teaches a different form of finance at an Indonesian university, but he does it in London. He's a magnificent guest on my program. I love having him on. We agree totally on the things we discuss, including Ukraine. These are the people contributing to the book, plus myself.
A lot of people. Is it a big book?
A lot of people, a lot of good people. And again, I've read everything but what Ed Herman and David Peterson will send. I'll get theirs tomorrow. And last one, if they're listening, if they're watching, Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Come on, guys, get me your chapter. We want to get this book published.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, what do you think? What do you think the worst possible scenario is to the Ukraine? Is it actually World War III or?
Yeah.
Is it
the worst possibility is an East-West confrontation, U.S. versus Russia. And if they ever get into a belligerent confrontation, I'm not predicting World War III, Stephen. I honestly don't think World War III will happen, but I know people a lot smarter than I am who think it's inevitable.
And that actual war is going to be a nuclear war too, isn't it? It's not going to be a conventional war.
That's exactly right. And I've quoted Hyman Rickover, the founder of America's nuclear navy. And I quoted him several times. And in one of my articles I'm putting out tomorrow, I quoted him again. He gave testimony to Congress in 1982. On the one hand, I guess he felt that developing nuclear weapons was important for defense. On the other hand, he dreaded them. He dreaded them. And his testimony to Congress proved it. And he told Congress that in a future war, belligerents will use every weapon in their arsenal to keep from losing. Now, take that a step further. If Russia and China go to war, they'll use every weapon in their arsenal to keep from losing. If they use nuclear weapons, I guarantee there'll be no Fourth World War, unless roaches and bacteria fight it.
And alligators.
And alligators. Microbes.
Microbes,
again,
yeah.
I'm not predicting it. But the possibility is too grave to risk. And yet neocons infest Washington. They infest the Obama administration. They've been around for years, and they're there, and they influence policy. Obama wants Russia co-opted. He wants it made into a pro-Western, pro-U.S. servile state. This is the story behind Ukraine. He's mad. He's willing to risk war to do it. And a war means a likely nuclear war, and a nuclear war means Armageddon. If that isn't reason enough to say no, I don't know what is.
Yeah, exactly. Do you consider yourself with the alternative media?
Oh, I do. Well, I'm associated with the Progressive Radio News Hour.
Okay.
That's the Progressive Radio Network, and my program is called the Progressive Radio News Hour.
Yeah.
And I finished my program an hour before you and I came on, Stephen. I'm on Sundays Live, and I archive two other programs, radio, not TV.
Sure, absolutely. Well, back last year, the alternative media was more or less the deciding factor in stopping war in Syria. Do you think we have that kind of a chance over here in the Ukraine?
I don't think the U.S. public knows what's going on in Ukraine. The only thing they know is Putin is the bad guy. The Ukrainian fascist running the government are the good guys. And the president they ousted was a bad guy. They know that. But a war hasn't broken out yet, Stephen. If there was a threat of war, if Obama was threatening war, which he is not overtly, he says he doesn't want to use military forces. So it hasn't gotten to that stage yet. But I remember last summer, when Obama was threatening war on Syria, And the mass outrage in America was enormous.
It was.
Congress was deluged.
It was.
With letters, with phone calls, with emails. Republicans, 300 no's to 100 yeses. And they jumped on this thing. And they absolutely refused to endorse it. And Obama had no choice but to postpone his war on Syria. He didn't cancel it.
Right.
He postponed it.
Right.
I think he still plans to wage it. And I think he plans war on Ukraine.
Oh, absolutely. What do you think it will take to stop it then? The same kind of effort?
Oh, yeah. That will stop it easily. But that's what we need. We need angry people. We need people to understand what's going on. We need them to say no more. We're sick and tired of these wars. We want the wars ended. We want the money used for these wars spent at home for education, for health care, for other vital services.
Homeless.
If America gets behind an agenda like this, no president, no Congress can say no.
Yeah. Well, we just have probably less than a minute left, Steve. So go ahead and plug your sites again, please, and then we'll say goodbye.
Anybody can access my site, a blog site, Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. That's the way I access it every day. My newest articles were up this morning. There'll be two more up tomorrow morning. It's a good place to follow me because everything I write there is in chronological order. I put my email address on the bottom of every article. If anybody emails me, I will answer.
Well, that's good. I know I have less than a minute left, so I do appreciate you coming on, Stephen Lendman, and a lot of great insights. Name of the book again, please, on Amazon.
The name of the book is Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. And, Stephen, it was a great hour with you. I really appreciate coming on with you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for coming on. And everybody, check out the book. I'm sure with all the great contributors, it will be a good one. I'm going to have to check it out myself. I have lots of books I need to get to, but that's not going to keep me from buying it. So there's my music, Steve, and I appreciate you coming on.
Many thanks, Steve.
All right. Have a good day over there. All right, everyone. Be right back in just a few minutes here.